It's a really great privilege for me to be with you all this morning, and a little sad, to be honest, for me. My dad liked to comment that he had a wealth of friends, and by that measure, he was the richest man that I know. And so thank you for being indirectly a part of my life and for being part of our family. So, when Arthur called me the end of last year and asked me if I would come and talk to you this weekend about a yet-to-be-determined passage from the Old Testament, I will confess to being a little intimidated. First of all, because I don't have an original thought in my head. You know, I am the goodwill store of your weekend. And secondly, because I struggle, somebody else mentioned this yesterday, I struggle with the Old Testament in my own study and my own devotions. I don't find it very accessible. I'm kind of a cut-to-the-chase kind of guy. I want God to just tell me what to think and what to do and get on with it. So the Hebrew poetry and the long list of genealogies and the list of good kings and bad kings, I find challenging. So I was really relieved when a couple months later, Arthur called me back and assigned me the book of Jonah. After all, it could have been Leviticus or Song of Solomon. So Jonah is easier for me because, I am Jonah in so many ways. So many of Jonah's reactions and responses to God are the way that I react and respond to God. And so in light of that, I've kind of organized the time this morning by identifying seven different problems that we have with God from the book, and then asking, what do we learn about God from the book as well? But before I jump into that, let me give just a very quick overview of the book for those of you who may not be completely current on it. We believe that the events of the book take place in about the 8th century B.C., so about a generation before the 12 northern tribes were carried off into captivity by the Assyrian Empire. And at the start of the book, God instructs Jonah, one of his prophets, to go to Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, and to preach against it because its wickedness had come up before the Lord. And Jonah didn't want to go. So Jonah gets on a boat and tries to sail to completely the other side of the Mediterranean Sea to the town of Tarshish, which is on the coast of Spain. And God responds by sending a storm. And as a result of the storm, the crew ultimately throws Jonah overboard. And Jonah is swallowed by a great fish. And he spends 3 days and three nights in the belly of this fish. And in a very interesting, kind of ironic, he's an interesting guy because he spends his time in the fish, apparently, giving thanks and worshiping God, which I find quite remarkable, that in stomach acid, that this is the time of the book that Jonah really worships God. So after 3 days, the fish spits him out, and God again tells him to go to Nineveh, and this time Jonah decides to go. Now, Nineveh was a big city. The Bible tells us it was about a 3 days walk around the perimeter of the city, which if a man can walk, say, 20 miles in a day, that makes it about the same circumference as I-285 around the city of Atlanta. So pretty big town. And Jonah walks through this town, and he's preaching that it's going to be destroyed in 40 days. And the people of Nineveh and the king repent. You know, they put on sackcloth and ashes, and they seek God's forgiveness, and God relents. Jonah gets angry, and he kind of throws this major temper tantrum. And God says, "Do you have good reason to be angry with me?" And at that point, Jonah doesn't answer. He kind of goes off to the east of the city, and he sits down, and he waits to see if God might change his mind again. He wants to see what's going to happen with the city. And God sends him a plant that provides him shade, That makes Jonah very happy. And then God almost immediately sends a worm, and the plant withers, and Jonah gets really mad again. And God again says, do you have good reason to be angry? And Jonah says, yes, good reason unto death. And the book ends with God asking another question. God asks Jonah, you know, you wanted to have compassion on this plant, and you did nothing to cultivate this plant. Why is it that I shouldn't have compassion on this city with its thousands of children and animals who are completely innocent? And we don't get any response. We don't know how Jonah answers that question or what happens. That's the end of the story. So problem number one, God asks us to do something that we don't want to do. In chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, again, God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh. He doesn't want to go. And we don't know why. It's not until chapter 4 that we learn that Jonah says he wanted to forestall God's forgiveness. But we don't really know why he wanted to forestall God's forgiveness. It could be that Assyria was the enemy of Israel, and that Jonah kind of wanted to see their capital destroyed. It could be, you know, that Jonah's a prophet, and he felt like his reputation would suffer if he goes and preaches the destruction of this city and then God spares it, because that's what he believes is going to happen, and he didn't really like that. But in any event, he had an agenda that was different than God's agenda. I grew up kind of hearing some very basic truths over and over again, so this may sound familiar to some of you. A genuine commitment to obedience is only revealed in those situations where I really don't want to do it. The rest of the time, God and I are just in agreement. And agreement is fundamentally different from submission. So what does my behavior demonstrate about my commitment to the Lordship of Christ in those situations when that commitment comes at a really high price? So what do we learn about God? Sometimes God will pursue us in our rebellion, like he did with Jonah. Most of the time, he won't. As a general rule, I think that we can expect God to sit back and watch us sail right off the spiritual map. One of the things that I pray in my own life is that God will bring about whatever is necessary to keep me from rebellion. That God will wash his hands of me is one of the most terrifying things for me to contemplate. On a side note, a couple of weeks ago, my mom gave me my dad's copy of the Tanakh, which is the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures. And he had written in the margins all kinds of questions and comments. And so, of course, the first thing I did was I turned to Jonah to see what he had written in the book. And next to verse 3, he had written this. Why didn't he just stay in Israel? That's what we would do. And I found that a typically really good insight. because I think that we are more likely to think that we can just stay right where we are and carry on, and that our rebellion is not going to have any significant difference in our relationship with God. To his credit, Jonah at least tried to hide, right? I mean, he was dumb to think that he could hide, but at least he tried. He had enough insight and awareness to know that his disobedience was going to matter. And I think that we don't have that awareness and that insight very often. We just think it doesn't matter. We're going to be more likely to just carry on going to church and coming to conferences and think that we're going to just skate right by. Problem number two. He leads us into danger and financial loss. In verses 4 and 5, God hurls a great storm at Jonah's boat that results in the loss of the entire cargo and threatens the life of every person on board. And I want you to note here that it doesn't say that God allowed the storm. It doesn't say that God worked through the storm. It said that God hurled the storm at the boat. And I just love that picture. A couple weeks ago, my boys and I went to a church function where we played dodgeball, father-son dodgeball, which I haven't played since sixth grade. But that's kind of the image I have. You know, we're hurling these balls as fast as we can at each other. And I will note that it doesn't matter how soft those balls are. If you get them going fast enough, they're going to sting. And I think as Christians, don't you find, as I do, that worshiping God is easier when things are going well in my life? The true test of our faith comes in those times of hardship, in sickness, in the loss of a job, in the loss of a loved one. I'm more likely to get mad at God in those situations when things aren't going well. I don't know if any of you happen to see the movie Miracles from Heaven, which, say what you will about the story and the theology, but I thought that the depiction of the mother's reaction to the illness of her daughter was typical of the way that we as followers of Christ are going to respond. The crisis of faith and the pulling away from God in the midst of that hardship resonated with me. So I think you have to ask yourself, do the hardships in my life lead me to a crisis of faith? And I will say that I think that they're likely to, if you don't embrace the lessons of Scripture, like in 1 Peter chapter 1, where it says, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." So what do we learn about God? First of all, that God is not a passive observer of what's going on in the world. He doesn't just allow events to happen and work through them to accomplish his purposes. God is the one hurling the storms at your life. He is, in all things, absolutely sovereign. Second, we learn that the trials and hardships that we experience are the tools that he is using to get us where he wants us to go, to keep us on track, or to prepare us for eternity. He's not cruel. He's not arbitrary. He's at work, and his purposes are good because he is good. Problem number three. He causes the innocent to suffer in order to accomplish his purposes. I want you to consider with me the crew on this boat with Jonah. They were terrified. They almost die. They lose their entire cargo, which may have meant financial ruin for them. And they're forced to throw a man overboard, which, understandably, they really, really didn't want to do. And contrast that with Jonah, who's asleep. He's not terrified. It isn't his cargo. These people are innocent bystanders, and it doesn't really seem fair. Interestingly, it's interesting to me that the crew responds to this by praying. And I think it's such an interesting comment on the human condition and a contrast to how we respond as Christians. So we as Christians are likely to get mad, but the unbeliever is likely to fall on his knees and seek divine intervention when things start going bad. As the saying goes, there are no atheists in the foxhole. As followers of Christ, I think we have to be ready to answer the question. If there's a God, and if he's as great as you say he is, why does he allow, fill in the blank, cancer, famine, war, Hurricane Matthew? I'm not going to try to answer that question for you this morning, but I will note that we learned something interesting about God here. Sometimes God allows us to see his redemptive purposes. In the case of the crew responds to this tragedy and the near loss of their lives by fearing God, by making sacrifices, making vows. And Lord willing, if we meet them in eternity someday, I will not be surprised if they don't say that this storm was the greatest thing that ever happened to them. So sometimes God gives us that happy ending. Most of the time, he doesn't. He doesn't share with us his design in taking the lives of almost 900 Haitians this month, and the loss of the homes and livelihoods of tens of thousands more. God very rarely allows us to understand the specifics of his purposes. Problem number four. We think we can overcome his will through our own efforts. The crew initially rejects Jonah's instruction to throw him overboard, and they start rowing more desperately. And God responds by increasing the strength of the storm. Here's a question I struggle with in my own life. When am I supposed to respond to hardships by submitting to the will of God? And when am I supposed to respond by working harder and striving more? When is God sending the storms in my life to help me get back on track and do something differently? And when is it an indication that I'm not submitting to the will of God? And when is it just a natural consequence of my own dumb decisions? When am I Jonah and when am I the crew? If any of you ever figured that out, I would love to know. Again, we learn something interesting about God when we reflect on the way that God responds to the crew and the way he responds to the people of Nineveh. The crew are in the midst of the hardship and they turn to God. The Ninevites anticipate the hardship and repent. In both cases, we see that God accomplishes his purposes. His will is not overcome. However, he's also merciful and forgiving. Repentance, humility, submission in the face of his wrath are never a bad idea. He likes those things. Problem number five. He asks us to believe outlandish stories. I'm going to talk more about this later. And Rodney, this is really kind of piggybacking on something Rodney said yesterday. But I want to note here that the story of Jonah spending 3 days and nights in the belly of a fish, you know, it is not uncommon. I mean, the Bible is kind of full of stories that stretch human credulity. And we have to ask ourselves if we're going to be willing to believe whatever it is that he has revealed to us. I think that believing the specifics of this story are not going to have terribly profound implications for your life and your doctrine and your theology. But in a broader sense, the decision to believe God or not is going to have huge ramifications for you. In Galatians 3, it tells us that Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. We learn that God demands to be believed. Belief equals faith, which equals righteousness. Belief equals faith, which equals obedience, which equals righteousness. That is the deal that God offers us. It's a package deal. You don't get one without the others. Problem six. We don't get the outcome from our obedience that we want. In chapter 4, we see how Jonah reacts to God's decision to spare Nineveh. He throws a major fit. I knew this would happen. I didn't want this to happen. I ran away to keep this from happening. You're exactly who I expected you to be. Kill me because I would rather die than live with this. He gets angry with God. When I understand that God is disciplining me, it's one thing. But when things don't go well in light of my obedience, that's especially hard for me. And I see this most often in my relationships with other people. Frankly, I struggle with relationships with other people. I'm generally the one that's right. So to interact with people in the way that I'm commanded to interact with them is really, really challenging for me. And And you know what? When I do it, when I obey and I do it the way that God instructs me to obey, that doesn't always go well. You know, it's not very satisfying. My sense of justice isn't placated, and I get angry. I mean, those situations make me angry. If I have responded correctly and other people haven't, that's hard. Interesting that we learn from God here that he doesn't justify himself to Jonah. He asks Jonah twice, "Do you have good reason to be angry?" The book closes with him asking that other question that we talked about. You wanted to save a plant. Why shouldn't I want to save a city? I suggest that God likes rhetorical questions. He, in the book of Job, he asks, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? And are you really going to annul my judgments?" In Romans 9, he asks, "Shall what is formed say to the one who formed it, 'Why did you make me this way?'" God never says, "It wasn't me. I didn't do it. Why aren't you angry with the other guy?" Our problems ultimately are always with God. So in our anger, God asks us, "Do you have reason to be angry?" In my life, the answer to that is no. No, I really don't. Problem number 7. We don't understand what God is doing, and his decisions seem arbitrary. We see this problem in the story of the plant in verses 6 and 7 of chapter 4. I'm going to move quickly through here because basically this is another example from the book of a similar problem. Jonah's watching, waiting to see what's going to happen with the city, and God sends the plant to provide him shade. Says Jonah was extremely happy about the plant. And then the next day when the plant withers and God sends a scorching wind, Jonah is extremely unhappy with God, and he's extremely uncomfortable and faint. And he says, again, "Let me die. Death is better for me than life." And I think that we learn that God sometimes leads us into situations that are extremely uncomfortable. I think God leads us into situations where sometimes we wonder, wouldn't death be better than this? In Jonah, again, we get to see what God's doing and his purposes. In my life, God never explains that to me. I'm going to close with 4 final points or applications for our time. First, I would like to exhort you and myself to embrace the study of the Old Testament. Jesus says in John 5:39 that the scriptures bear witness to him. By the scriptures, he means the Old Testament. That was the only scriptures they had at that point. The scriptures bear witness to him, he says. Jonah bears witness to Jesus. Genesis bears witness to Christ. The Psalms and the prophets bear witness to Christ. The God of the Old Testament and Jesus are one. If you cannot understand Jesus without understanding the Old Testament. If we don't study the Old Testament, we're going to significantly limit our understanding of God and his ways. Number 2, reflect on the difficult, maddening, or unfair situations or relationships in your life. And ask yourself, do you have good reason to be angry? First of all, I'd like to suggest to you that anger is the easy emotion, especially in our culture, especially for men, right? Anger is socially acceptable and easy, not tears. Not shame. Anger, it's very manly, right? But I think it's also, anger is the way I think we often mask the other emotions that we're experiencing that we don't want to deal with. that are uncomfortable for us. Fear, insecurity, pain, doubt. So, as you are going through these situations, ask yourself also, is it really anger that I'm feeling? Is that what's really driving what's going on for me? And if it is, work through that with God. Before you move forward, work through your anger with God. Recognize that your issue is with Him and resolve that before you will be able to resolve whatever the other situation is that you're facing. 3, do you struggle with the plausibility of this story? If you find that it's difficult to accept the idea that Jonah spent 3 days and nights in a fish, I would suggest to you that you're going to have a harder time facing the trials and tribulations of your own life. If hardships have the ability to lay waste to you, maybe it's because your God is small. Our God spoke the universe into being, created Adam from the dust. Our God numbers the stars and the hairs on our head. Our God was born of a virgin, healed the sick, raised the dead, gave sight to the blind. Our God gave up His own life for us and was resurrected and thereby defeated death and sin for all eternity. This is our God, right? The behavior of a fish is as nothing to our God. Finally, when you're called to go to Nineveh and you're sitting in the scorching sun and you're feeling as if you're about to die, remember the lessons of Jonah. Let go of why. Why can lead you into anger? Why can lead you into discontentment? Let go of trying to understand, demanding to understand why God is doing what He's doing. He doesn't owe you an explanation. And if you're like me and Jonah and Job, He's not going to give you one. Are you going to counsel me? In those situations, remember that He's the creator of the universe, whose thoughts and ways are way above yours and mine, that we serve the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords who loves us and gave up His life for us. And let go of why. Let go of the why and cling to the who. Thank you.